This is Authors Alcove, where writers learn from writers. Readers get the inside scoop, and everyone learns something. An episode comes out every Wednesday where writers share their latest work, every other Tuesday where us writers get taught by such experts as editors, book cover artists, and marketing execs, and beyond. So grab a cup of coffee, and let's dive into our next book. Hi, welcome to Authors Alcove. This is Agnes Wolf. Today I have award-winning novelist Paul Lamb. He has written 47 short stories, is that correct?
That's correct.
And
published.
Published, yes. And he has also recently published One Match Fire. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Could you just share a little bit about yourself and what brought you to become a writer?
It's unremarkable. I'm a husband and a father and a grandfather. I have four children, including a set of twins, and 11 grandchildren by last count, and that changed last summer, including a set of twins who happened to be born on the same day of the month as my twins, so that's interesting. Worked forever and ever for the man in the corporate world, just doing flunky work. And, you know, it was never a career, it was never a passion. It was always just paying the bills. But I was always writing. And I started out as a reader. And even when I was younger, somebody would say, "Where's Paul?" And my mother would say, "Oh, he's up in his room reading." And it was always true, because I was. And I, somewhere along the way, I said, "Wow, that would be a good gig, because there's no heavy lifting involved." But I didn't take into account the whole existential heavy lifting that is involved. It's hard work, actually, if you want to do it right. But I was writing for a long time feature articles for newspapers and magazines, and that was fine. It paid a little bit of money and gave me some self-esteem and some credentials. But all along, I'd wanted to write fiction, and I didn't know my genre yet, whether it would be fantasy or science fiction and so forth. So I flopped around a lot, got a few things published without much focus. And what I discovered was it wasn't so much finding a genre as in finding a style and a real confidence to say, I can sit down and I can write this now. Before it was like, how do I develop this character and what's the ending really going to be? But once I did achieve, it's been easy, I should say that. It's hard work, but I have a style and a confidence that I can trust. I can pull up and rely on when I need it and use it.
I know you mentioned that your genre is literary, and I know that has a lot to do with the style. Do you mind defining what you interpret literary as meaning?
Always understood it to be more character focused than plot focused, although many of my stories do bring in a little bit of supernatural, maybe. I like to call it magical realism. It's grounded in the real world. It's actual people. And that's not to say anything negative about the fantasy genre or the romance genre or anything. That's also hard work, and it has lots of people who really like reading that. And, you know, that's great. It's not mine. But I pursue my characters, try to look deep inside their hearts, and then try to write them as true as I can.
I know my mom and I, we read very different books, but the ones that we can always agree on are ones that would probably be considered literary, because we love that relationship and that character building. And it's just, usually it's, I'm not sure how to define it, but like, it's more artistic in a way.
I can see your point, although, you know, there's an art to every genre.
Yes.
It's more than just skill. It's an art. If you want to do it well and do it right.
Right. So I noticed when I was scanning through your 47 short stories, I didn't have a chance to read any of them, but I noticed that some of them said that it was from the world of One Match Fire. Is that accurate?
Yes. There are two ways to look at that. The novel One Match Fire has, I think, 24 chapters and a prologue. 10 of those chapters first appeared as short stories themselves in various lit mags, which leads to an interesting thing, and that is that I never intended to write this novel. I wrote a single short story, the one that became the prologue, about a man and his cabin in the woods and how he was going to have to sell it to pay his father's medical bills and all the anguish he has over that, because it had been part of his life forever. But the point of that, doing that, was to sort of give my children a template for what to do with my cabin in the woods, which I really have, and which may or may not be a cabin shown on the cover here. I'm not going to say. Anyway, and that was the point. It was just to give my kids an idea of how meaningful the cabin is to me and how they should be very gentle with it when my time is done. And I was fine. That was it. I was done with that. On to the next thing. But the characters kept coming back to me. And I thought, well, what would this character do in another situation? And what else is the cat has happened in their lives because of that cabin that they have down in the Ozarks? And so I wrote another story and then another. And pretty soon I had a dozen of these, most of which I was getting published. And I thought to myself, well, I guess I have a story cycle with the cabin as the unifying feature. And a writer friend of mine said, no, you don't. You have a novel. And the sooner you start looking at it that way, the better it will be. And so once I had that, I took off. And I wrote all the chapters. I looked at it and said, this covers 40 years. Where are there gaps? You know, well, I take this boy from about 7 years old to 17 years old. Maybe something happened in between there. I should write a story to fill that gap, that kind of thing. And that's how the novel came about. And I offered it to all kinds of publishers, tried to get agents for it. No luck at all. And I thought about serializing it on Substack, that newsletter-ish forum that where people will do this. And I knew if I did that, no one would ever read it, and it would sink like a stone. But coincidentally, one of the publishers I approached said, we like this. We'd like to publish this. Is it still available? And, you know, as soon as I calmed myself down, I wrote them back and said, oh, by the way, yes, it is still available. This would be wonderful. And then I had to ride the whirlwind. It went from accepted to published in 5 months.
Wow.
Which is astonishing. I said, wait, did you mean this year when they named the date? Yes. Yeah, we mean this year. So that happened. But the second way to look at the One Match Fire universe is that once I had this novel finished, I still kept writing stories about these characters. Stories that either happened outside of the theme of this novel or after the events in this novel. So they're part of the universe rather than the novel. And same thing happened. I have a couple dozen of those stories, and they're currently with my publisher under consideration, on submission, I guess it's the technical term. They've made sounds as though they want to publish it, but I haven't gotten anything official yet. So I think I have a sequel coming. And in the meantime, I've written two other novels about these people. So I'll be glad when they finally let go of me and I can work on something else.
I like that, though, because as a reader, because I always am very sad when I have to put the last book in the last series away. And you know there's none. The only way you can revisit those characters is to pick up the first book again.
Right.
But so I like that.
The novel under consideration right now is a true sequel. It happens chronologically later. Same characters. But the other one that I'm just finished first draft on spans the last few chapters of One Match Fire and the first few chapters of the other, and does a really deep dive into this one character who's a very troubled soul. And then the other novel is one that my editor said, oh, she would like to see. And that's about the wife of one of the characters. I dismissed that instantly. I can't write about that. I've never been a woman. So how could I possibly write credibly about a woman? And 185,000 words later, I finished that novel. That's monstrously huge for a debut writer. And I've given it to a number of people who happen to be women and said, how close did I come to getting this right? Tell me where this is wrong and that sort of thing. And I'm getting feedback on that. But that's sort of not a sequel. It's more adjacent to these two novels. So if you wanted to know this particular character, this woman that's in these other two novels, well, you want to read that then. I've really enjoyed doing it.
Do you mind just sharing a little bit about the plot without giving any spoilers of One Match Fire?
It begins with the prologue where the man who's in his middle age, I'd say he's in his 40s, goes out to the family cabin to begin prepping it to sell it. He's got to get out their private property and what are they going to do with this and figure out that. And what he finds when he goes out there is that his father, who is not a literate man in any way, had been keeping journals about what he saw and did out there. And this is astonishing to him that, you know, his father didn't even read cereal boxes, and yet he was keeping journals. So this is a very late in life discovery about his father. And what it does is galvanize his commitment to keeping the cabin, whatever else he has to do. If he has to sell a kidney, he'll do that, because his father's hospitalized and the medical bills are crippling them. And so selling the cabin would solve that, as well as betray his father's gift to him. Well, when he sees these journals, he decides to save. Then, after that prologue, it goes back 40 years, and we learn how his father was a drifter and never intended to have children, and comes to discover that that's exactly what he did want. Because he drifted, he never had anything solid, nothing to hang on to. And then when he finds he has a son, he recommits to that. He's going to be a good father, whatever he has to do. So then it follows being a father in all those years. And his son grows up. And one of the stories, chapters, is his son sneaking his girlfriend out to this family cabin. And oops, you know, something happens where he's going to be a father now. And so then the story can sort of pick up more with him learning the ropes and trying to do it right and trying not to do it wrong, and surprisingly getting estranged from his son. By the time his son is a teenager, they're not friends anymore, and it's sad, sad, sad. And the story ends with a resolution of that. So there's the story without too many spoilers.
Awesome. So what is the significance behind the title One Match Fire?
That is a family ritual at the cabin, to build a fire that you can light with only one match. You only need one match to do it. That means you're good with woodcraft. You know how to do it. And so father teaches son that. And then the second father teaches his son that. And in the subsequent sequel, the next son finds an even better way to do it. So, you know, it's evolving, but it is the family ritual. And it's a sign of unity among the generations.
And so there are three main characters, basically, that you follow throughout them.
Yes.
Is that, how are they different from one another, and how does that help the characters grow?
The grandfather, the man who built the cabin, is a very practical man. He's not well-educated, but he finds that he has a deep well of compassion in his soul once he has a child. He wants to do the right thing raising his son, who he learns very quickly is not a very confident person. He's shy. He's uncertain about everything. And so his father realizes he's got to instill confidence in this boy. That's his primary role as a father, is to prepare this boy for the really tough world of adulthood. Then when this boy is doing okay in life, I call him one of life's C students. He's going to be okay. He's going to be average. He's never going to do anything very huge and special, but he'll be all right. And then he meets this girl in high school, and everything changes. And of course, they have their challenges much earlier than they should, and they have a child. So then this insecure boy, I guess, at that point, is certain that he's ruined his life. He's ruined his girlfriend's life. He's going to ruin his son's life, and all of his self-doubt is reinvigorated. And she, of course, tells him, no, you know, you're the best thing that's ever happened to me, and so is this child, and we're going to make this work. And she does, and he slowly agrees with her until, you know, he has to sell the cabin to pay for his father's medical bills, and then it all comes back that he's terrible. And in the meantime, his son is brilliant. He's a precocious kid, top of his class, straight A's and everything, very different from his father, who was a C student. And he has a secret, and I won't tell you what it is, but it is the main driving force in their relationship. You can expect an adolescent boy to either revere his father or ridicule his father. That, you know, you're an old man, you don't know anything, and I know everything because I'm a teenager now, and that kind of thing. And that happens, but no one understands the reason it's happening. until that boy, who is, by the way, grows up to be a doctor, a pediatrician, which was my attempt to show that this oops child, this accident by these two teenagers, didn't have to be condemned to poverty. You know, that if you do it right and work really hard, maybe you can turn a corner and do something different with your life. And that's what this boy does. And it's after he's done all these great things that he finally approaches his father and says, okay, I have this secret I have to tell you. And when he tells him, his father says, okay, fine. And they're united once again. They've bridged the chasm between them, the emotional chasm. So there are differing personalities, sometimes at war with each other, sometimes skinny dipping with each other. And it's what I would say is a common human life.
One of the things that I also really wanted to talk to you about too is you've had a lot of success with your short stories. Do you mind just sharing like how you went about publishing those and how you found places that published them?
I guess, first of all, writing long enough to find my style and my confidence is the first big step. Never giving up, you know, even if it's, yeah. There was a time when I had four teenagers in my house. So if I wanted a hot shower, I had to be the first one up. And then it was a wonderful time to write because the house was quiet and I was alone and so forth. So, you know, developing my process and all of that was there. But there are a number of good resources for publishing stories. My favorite is a place called Duotrope, Doutrope, which is an aggregate of publishers and what they will publish. And you can filter this and say, I want to submit a story, a science fiction story that's 3,000 words. Who's interested in those? And then you plug that in and it'll give you 50, 60 possible publishers. Or I have a romance novel. Who's publishing romance novels or cozy mystery novels? And it'll digest all that for you. I love that site. It also lets you track your submissions and their outcomes. There is a fee for that. I think it's $50 a year. And I think it's worth every penny of that. And I tell other writers, you know, if someone wants to give you a Christmas gift or a birthday gift, get a subscription to this. Ask for this. It's better than a pencil or something stupid, you know. But there are also other sites on the web that will list publishers. I think Readsy does it. One I like is a woman named Erica Verillo keeps a blog called How to Get Published, and it has all kinds of things on it. But every month, she'll list who's got calls out this month and what their deadlines are and what they're interested in. And you have to do the legwork and research and see if it's your genre and your kind of thing and if you qualify. You know, there are a lot of places that say, we'll only take work from women. Okay, fine. I won't look at that one. A lot of Canadian publishers will only take work from Canadians, and that's, I understand that's because they get funded by their government and their government says you have to support the work of Canadian writers. So, okay, fine. You know, I don't qualify for that, but that leaves 5,000 other possible targets. So I'm not upset. I'm glad these people have something that's giving them focus. So there are a lot of online sites that you can do, but then you have to screw up the courage to actually submit to these places and somehow develop the resignation when you get rejected. But I always say, you know, rejection letters aren't bad. They're credentials. They show you're really trying. And, you know, there are stories of all these novels, famous novels that were rejected hundreds of times and then picked up at the last minute and then became Pulitzer Prize winners. So you got to get yourself in that mental space, I guess. And you have to have a good story. You really have to have written something that you're confident about, that you believe is true, that you believe is finished. Unlike poems, I understand, where you don't finish a poem, you just abandon it. I think I don't abandon short stories.
So then you ended up, did you end up doing traditional publishing with your One Match Fire?
Or yes. Yes, okay. I was.
How did you find that publisher?
That was against all odds kind of thing. I went to a site called CLMP. It's an acronym for, Consolidated Literary Management Publisher, something like that. And it just lists, I think, 700 publishers. and a vague comment about what they publish. And I was lucky, my publisher is Blue Cedar Press, so it was high in the alphabet. So before I had to see all 700, I found them. And it just they just said they were interested in books about or set in the Midwest, which is mine. Mine is in Kansas City and St. Louis and the little cabin down in the Missouri Ozarks. So I sent it to them, you know, with my vaguely standard submission letter. I believe I sent them the actual manuscript too. I guess I did. Some don't want the manuscript, some do, but this publisher did. And then 5 months later, they wrote me back and said, "Hey, we really like this. Is it still available?" And then I told you the rest. I went wild. Went to CLMP, which is another list. There are others like it. Most of it is repeats itself. You know, you see it on one site, you see it on another, but there's enough things that are fresh and new in each site that it's worth scrutinizing each one.
But your story is a little bit what everybody wants to experience, where they don't have to get very far down on the alphabet before they get accepted. Yes. But anyway, I just want to thank you so much for being part of my show. I do have one more question for you, and it's a question I ask everybody, and that is, what is one piece of advice that you would give to a not yet published author?
Can I give you two pieces
of advice? Of course.
Okay. Definitely. One, and it's one I've heard many of your guests say, is never give up. Persevere. Yep. If this is what you want, do it. And if you have to do it for yourself for a long time, you're still winning. The other is much more controversial, and I know that it goes against everything you've said on the show, but the rules of grammar are for chumps. We are creative writers. It's our opportunity, and it may be even our duty, to evolve the language. We're not writing term papers for high school. We're not working in the office. We're creatively writing. So if you want to split an infinitive, do it. Passive voice may be used, that kind of thing. My thought is that writing is such an insecure job. I mean, you sit down and you think, no one's going to read this. Am I doing this right? Who wants to publish this? All of these doubts. And so there's a seductive power in rules that, well, you should only use the word said in a dialogue tag. Oh my gosh, Elmore Leonard said that. It must be true. Or never use adverbs. Well, Stephen King said that. It must be true. Baloney. You know, no. If you read the literature, the big names, the successful names in your genre, you're going to see they're breaking all the rules. They always are. And someone would counter, well, they can do that because they're great. And I would say, no, they're great because they do that. So learn the rules, but then outgrow the rules. Know what works for you, what feels comfortable, what feels true to you. That would be my advice.
I can see that, because I was thinking, so I know that Shakespeare, Lewis Carroll, and Dr. Seuss all have created words that we now use in our everyday language, even though they were not words before they decided to put pen to paper and make them up themselves. Sure. But anyway, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I really appreciate the time that you took to share about your book. And I'll definitely be putting that in the show notes so that way people can check it out. But anyway, again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Agnes.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of Authors Alcove. We will be back next week on Wednesday, where we will have a writer share yet another piece of work. Also, every other Tuesday, we do learn from experts such as editors, marketing execs, book cover artists, illustrators, and more. If you are interested in being a guest on our show, feel free to go to authorsalcove.com, go to the podcast tab, and then click on Be a Guest. If you're looking for a healed heart, hop on over to our sister podcast, Strength, Love, and Healing with Authors Alcove. You can find that on Spotify and the Apple Podcast. Thank you so much for listening today. Have a great day.